Today is Wednesday, October 18th. We're working on Chapter 11, Nervous Tissue and Nerve Impulse Transmission. Okay, on page 92, you're looking at the organization of the nervous system. And the nervous system is actually divided based on structures and also based on functions. So let's talk first about the structural organization of your nervous system. This chart gives you a kind of an outline for how the nervous systems unfold. And if we look at it structurally, we're looking at the central nervous system being composed of the brain and the spinal cord, okay? So structurally, we're looking at what structures belong to each nervous system component, and the brain and spinal cord belong to the central nervous system. We can abbreviate that one as CNS. So structurally, the central nervous system includes your brain and spinal cord. The peripheral nervous system actually includes two sets of nerves. What are they?
Cranial and spinal.
Good. Cranial and spinal nerves. Good. So the peripheral nervous system structurally includes spinal nerves and cranial nerves. Okay, so what you'll notice underneath the central nervous system is there's two little components. You've got sensory division and motor division. That sensory division carries information from your cranial and spinal nerves to your brain and spinal cord for processing. That's actually a function of your central nervous system, okay? So your central nervous system actually receives incoming sensory information. Okay, central nervous system receives incoming sensory information. Notice there's also another function listed there under the CNS. That CNS includes an efferent motor division. That motor division carries out the demands or dictates of your central nervous system. So the central nervous system sends out motor information to your nerves. Okay, so that's a second function of your CNS. It does receive incoming sensory information. It also sends out motor information. Central nervous system also sends out motor information. Alright, so what are the two structures we find in our peripheral nervous system? Cranial nerves and spinal nerves, good. And then in terms of functions, we've got, you know, autonomic, somatic, we've got a further subdivision there, we've got sympathetic and parasympathetic. So, you know, functionally, that PNS, or peripheral nervous system, has multiple layers of functions. So we're going to talk today just briefly about somatic and autonomic nervous systems. We will save their details for later. Okay, so on your worksheet down below, it says, are there any functional subdivisions for the PNS? The answer is yes, there are two. Okay, so functional subdivisions of your PNS, yep, there are two. We can further subdivide this grouping into, say, somatic and autonomic, which we'll look at a little later on. Okay, so the functional subdivisions, we can look at things like somatic and autonomic, and we'll cover those details in a later chapter. blank.
Functions of the PNS.
Functions of the PNS send sensory information to the central nervous system. And it also receives outgoing motor information from the central nervous system. So send sensory to, receive motor information from. It's going to receive the sensory information sent, and it's going to dictate the outgoing motor.
Okay.
So it's kind of like the control center, you might say.
So the PNS sends it out.
Yeah, PNS sends it, PNS receives the motor. And so let's add something to that CNS function box to help clarify. For the central nervous system, let's also add it is an integration or control center. You can call it a control center. One more function for that CNS function box. The central nervous system is also a control center. Okay, central nervous system is also a control center. That's the only system that serves as a control center. Peripheral nervous system doesn't do that job. It is just sending information to the control center for interpretation, and it's receiving the messages that are outgoing and motor in nature. Okay, so just a big difference there, you know, in terms of control. The control center lies in the brain and the spinal cord. Does that make sense, what those PNS and CNS do? Okay, do you know how your thermostat works in your house? Okay, so if it's 80 degrees in your house and you want it to be 70 degrees in your house, what tips off that machine to turn on and start pumping out cold air? Gets past that set mark, right? So if you've got it set at 70 and it's now 80 degrees in there, a sensor, right? A sensor, that's part of the peripheral nervous system, tells that machine, which is the control center, hey, it's too hot in here, you should turn on and produce cold air. And so that machine gets that information, that machine is the one to make that decision. And so the pump is gonna turn on and then start making cold air, okay? And so the output mechanism are the vents in your home. So the vents carry the cold air back into your rooms, and that is the outgoing message, in other words, carried by your peripheral nervous system. Okay, let's do another example, but let's use your body for this example. If you are too hot, there are sensory receptors in your skin, and those sensory receptors tell your brain about your existence in a really hot environment. What does your brain as the control center decide to do?
Sweat.
Yeah, you gotta sweat, you gotta cool the body temperature down. The brain says you need to sweat, but the brain itself can't sweat. So we then in turn take messages by motor pathways to PNS. Yep. We tell those sweat glands in the peripheral nervous system pathway, hey, the message for you is sweat. Okay? And as long as you're too hot, that PNS pathway is going to go to those sweat glands and say, you got to sweat, okay? Once you get back to a normal body temperature, what happens to this whole mechanism? It stops, right? This sounds like what type of feedback loop?
Negative.
It is negative, good. So the sensors and the motor pathway are nothing more than conduits. They're nerves that go to your brain and spinal cord for the decisions to be made by your brain and spinal cord. So I want to make the point here, since we're having this conversation, that your sweat glands don't decide to sweat. Your sweat glands don't even know you're too hot. The only way your sweat glands know to sweat is if what tells it to sweat? Yeah, brain, spinal cord has to send out a message telling you to sweat. So think of that brain and spinal cord as a set of control centers. Does that help clarify the roles a little better? Okay, we'll actually go into more detail as we get into the spinal cord cross-section. You guys haven't gotten there in lab yet. We'll be doing that probably in the next, say, 2 or 3 weeks. So we'll talk more about how information comes in and goes back out through a motor pathway. So this is just kind of a tip of the iceberg at this point. Do you have your blanks filled in there? Page 92. Some of them? Which ones you missing?
But the PNS on the very bottom is so, it says, if so, what are they, or what are their functions, what would be the functions for them?
somatic, we'll worry about those in chapter 13 and 14, but somatic is, it's skeletal muscle information, motor control of skeletal muscles. Autonomic is involuntary control of, say, smooth muscle, cardiac muscle. But we'll spend a whole chapter on those later on. So somatic control, skeletal muscle. Somatic control, skeletal muscle, and autonomic controls involuntary smooth. Autonomic controls involuntary smooth and cardiac muscle. Okay, involuntary.
We need to know. Oh, I see. The skeletal one, cardiac.
So somatic control, skeletal muscles. Autonomic control, smooth and cardiac muscles.
What's the answer for the box is asking about for the PSN? What structures are found here?
Spinal nerves, cranial nerves.
Is that also the central nervous system?
Brain and spinal cord. Sure. So just to carry the concept a little further, on page 93 at the top, you have the functions of the nervous system summarized. You ever lay your hand on a hot stove, hot toaster oven, hot grill? You jerk your hand away pretty fast, right? Doesn't take long. That is a reflex, something we'll talk about in here quite frequently. And reflexes are programmed into your brain and spinal cord. So your brain doesn't have to think about what to do. And your spinal cord is automatically programmed to respond without you having to go, that's really hot. I feel my hand sizzling. I think I should pull it away. That conversation is not held by your brain or your spinal cord. Your brain and spinal cord simply say, ouch, pain, move it away. So this is a great way for us to understand what sensory integration and motor functions are for your nervous systems. So let's talk about the sensory input. If you lay your hand on a hot stove, there are sensors in your hand that feel pain. Okay, so if it's really hot, that's going to cause a sensation of pain. So you'll notice there, blanks to fill in, there are receptors in skin and joints. There are receptors in skin and joints. These sensory receptors are nothing more than tattletales. They don't make decisions. All they do is tattletale to the central nervous system. So these tattletales in the skin and the joints tell on you. They say, ha ha, you just laid your hand on a hot stove. That's all they know to tell, right? Okay, so they come running to your brain and your spinal cord and they say, you laid your hand on a hot stove. Right here is an interneuron, okay? That interneuron is sitting either in your brain or your spinal cord. And this example that I'm using, that interneuron is in your spinal cord. And that interneuron, being part of your central nervous system, is part of a control center. And so the interneuron says, I know what to do when you put your hand on a hot stove. You should move it. Yeah. So that interneuron, all big and bad, thinks it's made a really mighty decision here. And so that interneuron turns around and tells this neighboring motor neuron, move. Okay? And so the message comes back out to a skeletal muscle. And that skeletal muscle in your arm makes you contract and move your arm away from the source of pain. So you'll notice that the motor neuron there is going to send out a message. Here's two blanks for you. To muscles. We send out messages to muscles. Send out messages to effectors called muscles and glands. Send out messages to muscles and glands. Yeah, because if you had to go up to the brain and back down, you'd have several seconds lost. Yeah. Yeah. And by that time, you may have worse damage. Exactly. So if we were using that whole issue of, you know, I'm too hot, it's, you know, I'm 80 degrees, you know, I'm looking for a house to be 70 degrees, this time that effector may be a sweat gland that tells you to sweat. So you can see that the muscles or the glands, they don't make the decisions here. All they do is carry out the job that they're told to do. So I'm trying to make the point that the decision-making process resides with only one of these three types of neurons. Which type? Yeah, that interneuron, right. So the integration process, the process of making a decision, is something that only those neurons in the central nervous system can do. We don't have decision-making ability in our fingertips, you know, in our peripheral nerves. We don't have them in our motor neurons. All they do is carry out the job they've been told to do. What's that?
I said that they're just the workers.
They're just the workers. That's a good way to think of it. Yep. So what we've talked about are just generalized functions of your peripheral and central nervous system, all kind of knitted together. Looking at the very top of your page, can you tell me which only function is a CNS function? Control center, and it's step number two. Yep, step number two, performing integration. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, top of 93. Okay. So which nervous system controls steps one and step three, sending sensory and receiving motor?
PNS.
PNS, right, that's peripheral nervous system. All I did for you next was I mapped it out, but this time I used neurons as the players here. We've got sensory neurons taking information to the central nervous system for discussion and decision making. The central nervous system then makes a decision on how to handle a problem. And those are called interneurons, sometimes called integration neurons, and sometimes called association neurons. Don't you wish they would just pick a name? Okay. So the one I commonly use is interneuron because it kind of makes me think of a middleman that we are talking between sensory and what? Motor and the PNS, yeah. So the interneuron is kind of like the middleman. It talks between incoming sensory and outgoing motor. Both sensory and motor are in the PNS. Okay, so down there, you got a blank to fill in. This time, interneurons are found only in what system?
CNS.
Good. Interneurons are found only within your CNS, central nervous system. So, you know, sometimes people damage a sensory neuron and they lose the ability to feel anything where that neuron's been damaged. Other times people may lose motor control, which means that the pathway to a skeletal muscle has been damaged and maybe they can no longer move that particular area. So you may actually have functional sensory in one body part, but not functional motor skills in that body part. So there are actually two pathways in each nerve. You've got sensory neurons carrying information to your brain and spinal cord, and you've got outgoing motor information carrying information to those skeletal muscles and those glands. So it is a two-way street. You can't have one functional and not the other. So something we'll kind of explore a little more as we get further into like autonomic function later on. So let's talk about neuroglia near the bottom of your page. This is a very important component of nervous tissue. So now we've dabbled in nervous tissue throughout this course. Now we're going to kind of dive headfirst into it. We know that in nervous tissue we have neurons, and we also have support cells called neuroglia. Just to compare here, neurons conduct nerve impulses. We knew that, right? Okay. They do lose the ability to divide, damage a neuron, and you can permanently impair its function. And these neurons are also protected and insulated by the neuroglia. Neuroglia are technically nerve glue. Neuroglia are considered support cells. They support, they protect, they insulate. This is kind of an interesting thing to take note of. They never lose the ability to divide. And that comes with a double-edged sword. The good news is, if you have damaged neuroglia cells, they can repair themselves by continually dividing. The bad news is, if they continue to divide without listening to the message that they're supposed to stop dividing, what can they do to you? They can cause cancer, right. So you may have heard of brain cancers that grow quickly and damage many parts of the brain, and unfortunately cannot be surgically removed because they intertwine through so much brain tissue. That most likely comes from neuroglial cells that go on a wild dividing spree and invade all that brain tissue.
So are they the ones that can create tumors inside the brain?
They're the ones that create tumors, exactly.
Glioblastoma would be.
Yes.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
We have two nurses I work with that within like months of each other, both their husbands were diagnosed. One's husband passed, so like, you know, it's really rapid.
Wow, that's incredible to have. That's such a rare cancer and then have two of them.
Mm-hmm. Back to back.
Yeah. I believe that's what John McCain has. Yeah.
You don't live long.
No, sure don't.
The brain can only tolerate so much.
Yeah, and when it starts invading all those vital functions, yeah, can't work as a control center.
Without the control center, the rest of the body don't know what to do.
Exactly. Right. Interesting stuff going out there in research. They're actually using other animals that do not lose the ability to divide in their neurons to see if they can do the same thing for human beings. You may know that if you snap off a lizard's tail, you know, the little green anoles, if they lose their tails, they can grow back their tails. Obviously, it has sensation. Obviously, it has motor control. So there's some part of their body that doesn't say, hey, wall this off and form scar tissue like we do. But their body says, hey, let's regrow this body part. So, you know, hopefully in the near future, maybe the next 20 years, 30 years, it'd be great to be able to see us to regenerate those nerve cells if they've lost the ability to divide. Turn that back on and let us regenerate nerves where we need to have nerve control once again. It'd also be great to tell these neuroglia, if they're dividing wildly and out of control, to shut off their division, and then that way they can, you know, control brain cancers and things of that sort. So I thought I'd just take you through a quick tour of some of the more common neuroglia. Near the bottom of your page, you'll notice that we are looking at first support cells in your central nervous system. The first type there is called a microglia cell, and this one is a phagocyte. What does it do for a living?
It eats.
It eats, yeah. So it is on the move, it patrols your brain and your spinal cord, and it eats. So it eats bacteria, it consumes debris that gets into that area. The next type of neuroglial cell is called an astrocyte, and the word astro makes me think of a star, and they are in fact star-shaped. These are the ones that can form those glioblastomas, those brain cancers that grow very rapidly. They're very important though when they're functional. They help to form what's called a blood-brain barrier. That actually helps to insulate around your capillaries in your brain and prevents them from leaking fluids that are unnecessary for the rest of your brain tissue. So we'll talk more later on about this thing called a blood-brain barrier. We'll come back and revisit these astrocytes.
So you're saying there's capillaries inside the brain?
There's capillaries. There's tons of capillaries in the brain, but they're not supposed to perform like the same types of exchanges that the rest of our capillaries do. They're only supposed to let certain items out into the brain tissue. So this is meant to keep things like bacteria, viruses and other things from entering into your brain and spinal cord. Let's say we have a really long word here. This one's called an oligodendrocyte. And the important thing to know about this one, it helps to form a myelin sheath. That myelin sheath is like a wrapping around the axons, yes, kind of like an insulator for our neurons. So I want you to think of a toilet paper or a paper towel roll. You know how that wrapping goes around and around? That's exactly how one of these oligodendrocytes works in the brain or spinal cord. So it actually makes an insulating wrapping, just like you have on, you know, wires. You know, if these wires were not insulated, we wouldn't be touching wires, right? Zap. So this helps to ensure that the nerve is wrapped, insulated, and it also helps to speed up nerve impulse transmission. The last of our central nervous system neuroglial cells is called an ependymal cell. You'll notice these are ciliated. What do cilia do for cells? Hula dancers, right? Okay, so they sweep and they move debris or dust, or in this case, fluids, past these stationary cells. These cells aren't swimming. These cells are sitting stationary, and they're kind of like hula dancers. They move fluids past them, and that helps to create a current of cerebrospinal fluid in your brain. So we need to circulate cerebrospinal fluid through the cerebrum and the spine. And so these cerebrospinal cells, these ependymal cells, actually help to create that current. So you can lay completely still. People can be completely paralyzed from the neck down, and those ependymal cells can still create a current that helps to move those fluids, you know, through the brain and the spinal cord. To help you keep this straight, let me point out that our two S words, Schwann cells and satellite cells, the two S words are found in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, the two S words are found in the PNS. And they both protect and wrap and insulate. You'll notice that satellite cells protect and wrap your cell body. The Schwann cell helps to form a myelin sheath. You know, we just talked about making a paper towel roll or a toilet paper roll, wrap around and around. That's what those Schwann cells do. So we just got through talking about the oligodendrocytes. The oligodendrocytes form the myelin sheath around cells in which nervous system?
CNS.
Good. So by comparison, Schwann cells do the exact same thing, but they're wrapping cells found in the
PNS.
Yeah, that's just something to keep straight there. Got any questions so far? So I just wanted to show you how a myelin sheath forms. This is a pretty cool process. It is just like making your own paper towel or toilet paper roll. That myelin sheath is formed when one of those oligodendrocytes or Schwann cells wraps around and around the axon or the long extension off of a nerve cell. And the cool thing about it is when you've got a myelin sheath, you've got what's called white matter, and that actually increases the speed of a nerve impulse transmission, because all you've got to do for a nerve impulse is let it hop, skip, and jump down the length of that axon to the bare naked zones that are called nodes of Ranvier. So that's kind of a cool concept that we see with white matter in both brain and spinal cord. Most of your PNS nerves are also going to be wrapped with a type of Schwann cell that helps to insulate them. So if you've ever heard of multiple sclerosis or MS, that happens to occur when the central nervous system myelin sheaths are damaged. So what are the cells that form the myelin sheath in the brain?
Fancy word.
The O word. The good. Oligodendrocytes. Good. If they harden, then no longer can that nerve impulse hop, skip, and jump. So unfortunately, that means that nerve impulse may go awry, And in this picture, you kind of see it's like taking an electrical cord and cutting it. And then if you happen to touch it, you get zapped because the electrical signal is traveling not down the cord as it's supposed to, but it's zapping out wherever it's got an opening. So that's the unfortunate thing about MS. Sometimes a person may experience problems with vision. Sometimes they may have sensation issues. And it, you know, the body's trying to repair these damages to the myelin sheath, but ultimately what ends up getting replaced there is scar tissue. These scar tissues actually show up as plaques in the brain. You can see them in this picture here on the right. Okay, and also you can see some scar tissue plaques built up here. I had a student many years ago out here. She was going through the nursing program. She was taking one of the bio courses with me. And she was, you know, high stress on herself. She was, I've got to make an A kind of person. And, you know, it's one thing to make an A through Bio 210 and 211, but that's a lot more stress when you get in the nursing program to say, I got to make an A on everything. So when she was in my class, she was not yet in the nursing program, and she complained of having, like, you know, a numb spot in her leg for 2 or 3 weeks, and then it went away. And, you know, like most of us, we say, oh, it's gone. I must have had a pinched nerve. I probably said funny. And then she had a spot on her stomach that was numb for a few weeks. It too went away. She probably said, you know, it was okay. It was just something I did. Yeah, eventually it hit her eyes. And when she had blind spots, you know, floating through her eyes, and she says, something's going on here. So all of these were symptoms that were connected. And nowadays, really all they can do for this autoimmune disease is just help you manage your stress. They do give vitamin B12 shots. It seems to reduce the inflammation and the further damage to those myelin sheaths. But, you know, for her going through nursing school, they just said, you've got to manage your stress, which is the most impossible thing to tell somebody who's going through nursing school, right? So this is a problem that often affects women more than men. So if you know somebody who occasionally has numb spots that float around, and especially if it hits your vision, you know, get checked, because there are things they can do to help somebody manage this disorder. It affects something like 3 times as many females as males. And it may be nothing more than just an environmental trigger, something like stress in your life, that can turn on the autoimmune response that damages these Schwann cells, or actually oligodendrocyte cells. Okay. So far, so good. Got questions on page 93. Y'all comfortable with neuron structure? Okay, let me give you a moment. Let's run down through those structures on page 94. Make sure we're good to go there. Okay, so this is a typical motor neuron. You'll notice this motor neuron looks kind of like a tree, and the tree has a bunch of branches sticking off. It has a long trunk, and it has roots in the ground. So when we're talking about this tree aspect of a neuron, we're talking about the dendrites forming the tree branches. We're talking about the axon forming the tree trunk. And of course, those axon terminals form the tree roots. So it's kind of an interesting way to think about the structure of a neuron. I do want to mention that nerve impulses always travel in one direction. They always travel from your dendrites toward your cell body, and then where? Down the axon to the axon terminals. That is the only direction nerve impulses will travel, from dendrites to cell body, down that axon and toward those axon terminals. So that means if you need a nerve impulse to go in the other direction, you've got to have a wiring of neurons traveling in that other direction. This is the only way those neurons will depolarize and send nerve impulses. Top of the page, cell body is the main location where the nucleus and organelles are housed. This is kind of like the business center of your neuron. This is where the activities, the metabolism, the decisions are made in this central portion here around that nucleus. The next one on your list is called an axon, and the axon always carries information away, A for A, right? Axons carry away from your cell body. Okay, and they can be typically one per cell. There are some special neurons that may have more than one, but in most cases we find one per cell. They can be 3 to 4 feet in length, such as in the case of your legs. You know, so you may have like a sciatic nerve that travels down your legs. It's extremely long compared to others that may be very short. All right, and when we get to the end, we end up having these little terminal endings called axon terminals. They are sometimes called synaptic knobs. And what do they release when a nerve impulse travels there?
Acetylcholine.
Yeah, they can release a neurotransmitter. It may, in fact, be acetylcholine. Good. All right, so that is a blank for you all to fill in. Under the function, the action potential causes those axon terminals to release a chemical called a neurotransmitter. And you're right, that neurotransmitter may in fact be acetylcholine. All right, number three are dendrites. Those dendrites send information toward your cell body. I kind of think of them like satellite dishes. They're out there looking for incoming information. And when they receive that information, they always generate an impulse toward your cell body. And then that impulse travels down your axon to those axon terminals. And then finally, we've talked a little bit about this myelin sheath already, but this is a wrapping of a protective cell around the axon. So you'll notice that the function is to wrap and insulate and protect the nerve fibers. Notice there's two blanks to fill in. The first blank says it forms the myelin sheath around nerve fibers in the PNS.
The swan cells.
Swan cells, good. Okay, that blank with the letter E beside it, that is for swan cells. The next blank is for something called a node of Ranvier. If you need the spelling there, it's R-A-N-V-I-E-R. And you can imagine taking a cable and lining up toilet paper rolls one after another. There's going to be a teeny tiny bit of space between those rolls, just like there are between swan cells. And that's where the nerve impulse will hop, skip, and jump. So you'll notice in this picture, the nerve impulse only has to travel to those little bare-necked spots called the nodes of Ranvier. Those gaps where we have no myelin sheath is the only place the cell has to depolarize. And then it skips to the next necked spot and depolarizes there. This process actually speeds up nerve impulse transmission, and nerve impulse transmission travels a lot faster anytime you have myelination. We also call anytime you've got myelin sheath wrapping a nerve cell, we call it white matter. Okay, and if there's no wrapping, then we call it
gray
matter. Good. And that's, of course, the last two bullet points down there. All right, so nerve cells, that's something you're fairly comfortable already seeing before. Okay. Let your brain clean out. Clear thoughts, empty brain cells, right? Ready for them to be filled up with information, right? Okay, we're going to spend the next 30 minutes looking at something called nerve impulse transmission. So I just want your brain to have clear thoughts, nothing clogging it up right now, and take a deep breath. Okay.
Whew. Sound of it, this one's going to be a lot more.
It's a little more detail, yeah. So what we did last week with excitation contraction coupling, we are just taking excitement, okay? We're not worried about contraction right now. We're just going to take excitement. And so we're going to follow this through a few steps. Let's see, we've got page 95, 96, 97, and you know what? You already know page 98. And then what I did was I turned around and I did it again on pages 99, 100, 101, and 102. Oops, just a 101. So you've kind of got the process on there twice. So what I'd like to do is give you some foundation, and then we'll start looking at those three pages. I want to give you some background information first. So we're going to be talking about resting potential, or just the resting state of a nerve cell. And I might as well say that this could be the resting state of a muscle cell, same thing. And then there's something called an action potential, which is another way to say a nerve impulse. And then we get down to these axon terminals. And we've already talked about how we transmit across the synapse. We've talked about the neurotransmitter. We've talked about it binding those sodium channels. That's going to be the same exact story once again. So what I need to do is give you the foundation for resting potential and how action potential can be generated. So what I need to do is introduce to you a resting nerve cell. This resting nerve cell has a polarized membrane. Okay, and what we mean by polarized is there is an uneven distribution of ions on either side of that membrane. There are two ions that we're going to pay attention to for the duration of nerve impulse transmission. They are sodiums and potassiums. Good. You may notice that both sodiums and potassiums carry a positive charge. So using our chemistry lingo, they are
cations.
Good. They are called cations. All right. What if I told you at rest, we would have more ions outside the nerve cells in the interstitial fluids, and we would have less ions inside the cell? You know, that gets wordy. If I had to constantly say we have more of them outside and less of them inside, that comparison gets really bogged down in too many words. What they've done, if they've simply said, wherever you've got more of the ions, we're going to say that's where you carry a more positive charge, okay? So the lingo just becomes a little cleaner. All we have to do is appreciate that wherever you've got the majority of your ions, that's what we're going to say is the positively charged area. What should we say about those areas that have less ions? It's got a more negative charge, right? Okay, you know what's tricky about this? There's all cations in our conversation, okay? So when you say you've got more of them in one area and it's a positively charged environment, and you have less of them somewhere else and it's a negatively charged environment, that's a little confusing because they're all positively charged. So all we're doing is comparing where the majority are hanging out. And in a resting state neuron, we have the majority hanging out outside your cell, and there's mostly sodiums out there. And inside your cell, you've got a few ions, but the most of those are actually potassium ions. I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing here. What symbol does sodium carry?
Na.
Good. And potassium?
Na.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's why in this picture, they've got positive or pluses on the outside of this nerve cell. Those sodiums are hanging out in your interstitial fluids. Inside, they've got negative charges, and that's simply to represent that we have less ions inside your cell. Okay, and so when you have an uneven distribution, you've got more on one side, less on the other side, we say you have a polarized or a resting membrane potential. Let me give you an analogy to think of it a different way. You ever been to a concert? Okay, so the gates open, the doors open at some particular time, right? The crew is on the inside setting up the concert. Everybody else is on the outside waiting to get in. That is what's happened during a polarized nerve cell. The majority is hanging out outside waiting for the doors to open, and there's just a few on the inside, and that's all it is, just a few in there. So technically, we would say where the crowd is, what charge do you have?
Positive.
Positive, right? And the crew on the inside?
Negative.
A negative charge. Right. What's that?
They're waiting to be finished.
They are. They're waiting for the positive surge to come in. Sometimes, let's use that concert analogy, you find a back door that you can sneak in and see the band setting up, right? Okay. And they find you poking around inside the concert hall and they say, what are you doing in here? Get out. Okay? And so that's where the sodium potassium pump comes into play. There are a few stragglers from the inside that will leak out, and there's a few stragglers from the outside that may come to the inside. And anytime you got stragglers making their way to the other area, this pump says, get back where you're supposed to be, and it's going to pump constantly three sodiums to the outside, and it's going to pull two potassiums back to the inside. Let me repeat that. You're going to take three sodiums to the outside, two potassiums to the inside. Three sodiums out, two potassiums in. When you're at rest, it actually happens like all the time.
That's just the process of it.
Just the process of it, yeah. You can think of it like kind of the bouncer moving everybody to the right location, and it's always working. What we're talking about here is a nerve at rest. A nerve at rest is going to have more sodiums on the outside. Sodium outside carries a positive environment. There's potassiums on the inside. The inside's a negative environment because there are less ions in general inside as compared to what you've got on the outside. Okay? And there's stragglers. There are some sodiums that may come in. There are some potassiums that may leak out. And we have this pump called a sodium potassium pump. It's going to be constantly running, and it's going to be moving three sodiums out and two potassiums in. The whole goal here is to maintain that resting negative charge state on the inside. Let me make a point about this. You're not moving three for three, right? You're moving three out and two back in. Where are you putting the majority of your ions? You're putting them out, and you're only putting two back to the inside. The reason for this is to maintain that imbalance, right? The majority of your ions have to be outside to maintain a resting state. There have to be fewer on the inside. So that's why this pump moves three to two and not an equal amount, okay? Because if you moved an equal amount, you would have an even distribution of charges and your cell would no longer be at rest. Okay, does that make sense? So the charge right now at rest is actually measured in negative millivolts. So we say that our charge at a resting state is negative 70 millivolts.
And this is all at the body, right?
This can be at the body or the dendrite. It even can occur at the axon. You're talking about the neuron?
Well, like the resting state that we're talking about, right?
Yeah, the resting state. It could be the whole length of that axon or that whole cell. Recap what we've covered so far. This is a piece of an axon. It's sitting here in a resting state, and we're looking at that axon inside here, and the interstitial fluid is sitting around the outside of that cell. So at rest, what is the charge inside your cell?
Negative 70.
Good. It's negative. You're right. It's a negative 70 millivolts. So why do we say the outside carries a positive charge? What's out there?
There's more ions outside.
More ions out there, right. And the majority of the ions are? They're sodium, good. So we'll just put some sodium ions hanging out outside. We'll put a random potassium out there. So what's the most common ion you have on the inside of your membrane?
Potassium.
So we'll put a few of those inside. All right, so we call that a polarized neuron. Feel pretty good? And so there's a sodium potassium pump that's working constantly. We'll just put one down here. And that sodium potassium pump gets the stragglers where they need to go. It's going to put how many sodiums back outside?
Three.
Yeah, it's going to put three sodiums outside. And how many potassiums?
Two.
Good. I think we hit that page. Yep, I think we're good. All right, looks like we're ready for page 96. Let's talk about what happens to depolarize a cell. Story from this point forward. Most of the story from this point forward is a familiar story that we've covered with excitement. Along comes a neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter might as well be acetylcholine, so let's just use that because our conversation's familiar now. And acetylcholine has come along and has bound a portion of our axon. It maybe has come in contact, maybe it's bumped it or something of that sort. So that acetylcholine will come and bind a receptor site that sits on what type of channel? Sits on a sodium channel. Okay, so there's our acetylcholine. It binds the sodium channel. And when acetylcholine binds that sodium channel, that sodium channel opens. And let's go back to our initial picture. Where are most of our sodiums sitting?
Outside.
And the least were found
inside.
And they say, oh, hot diggity, our doorway is open, and they go into that cell. Yeah, they flow. So it's a chemical gradient. They flow from high concentration to low concentration, and they come into this cell through those open sodium channels. So now we've got sodiums coming inside, and now where are the majority of your ions?
Inside
the cell. Okay, so let me put a few more sodiums in here. Recap our values here. We know that we started with a cell at rest, and the values there were negative 70 millivolts. when you open up these sodium channels and sodiums begin to rush into your cell, the inside becomes negative 65. You're getting more ions inside. It now is negative 60. Even more ions are flooding in. There's a critical value, though, that you hit, negative 55. What happens at that value?
You reached the threshold.
Good. So let's make note that threshold. Those are negative signs. That's negative 55. Let me introduce something called the all or none principle, since we're talking about threshold right now. Up until this point, you have what's called a graded potential. That means you're getting a little bit of sodium flooding in right here. But once you reach threshold, we're going for it. There is nothing halfway about it. You can't just partially do it. You know, there's a word for this we oftentimes say, right?
All or none.
All or none. Yeah, you're either all in or you're not doing it. So when you hit negative 55, that nerve cell is committed. It's going to conduct an action potential. So up until negative 55, all you're doing is just messing with that axon. And that sodium-potassium pump is having to clean up the mess. It's pumping out 3 sodiums. It's pulling back in 2 potassiums. But once you hit negative 55, you have enough charge inside your cell that your cell is going for it. It's going to conduct an action potential. So we say up until this point, we're just simply doing what's called depolarization. Let me squeeze that in between these two words. So what does threshold guarantee will happen?
An action potential.
Guarantees an action potential. Good. You ever been at a football stadium, basketball game? You see this happen, right?
Yeah, the wave.
The wave. And you see somebody sitting there and think, poor fool, nobody's going to help them out. And you sit there and think, maybe they'll stop doing it after a while. And then eventually it catches on, right? Okay, and then you don't feel so sorry for them because somebody's actually playing along. So if you see somebody sitting there doing this, you know they're trying to get that wave to start up. And if they're just sitting there doing it by themselves, where are we? We're kind of depolarization resting state there, right? If you can get the whole group to do it with you, what did you reach?
Threshold,
right? And then everybody's doing it. It's all or none, right? And everybody's doing it. And so when you do that, you are now full on conducting action potential. And that's just a fancy word that means a nerve impulse. Okay? I want to note that that is around positive 30 millivolts when you reach the height of an action potential. Things to think about here. Is depolarization the same thing as an action potential?
No.
Is depolarization the same thing as an action potential?
No.
Now, because what do you have to meet to guarantee that it becomes an action potential? Negative 55 threshold, right. Okay. And once you reach threshold, these sodium channels, it becomes like contagious excitement. this one's going to open, the next one's going to open, and it just starts opening like a domino effect down the length of your cell. So that threshold is going to cause those voltage-gated sodium channels to pop open, and then sodium just rushes in down the length of that ion or that axon. So that's how we conduct an action potential. The excitement that comes from having reached threshold unlocks and opens adjacent sodium channels. So here's the thing. You don't necessarily need acetylcholine to bind but a few of these sodium channels, get the excitement going, hit threshold, right? And then the rest of them, they don't need acetylcholine. All they need is the excitement. So the wave of excitement opens the axon sodium channels all the way down to that axon terminal. Okay? And so, you know, this can also work without acetylcholine. If you've ever bumped your funny bone, it tingles, you know, all the way down to your fingertips. So all it takes sometimes is not even a neurotransmitter, but a bump on a nerve. And that bump on the nerve will cause an excitement. It'll make you reach threshold. And you'll feel a tingle all the way down to your fingertips because you've excited that nerve cell or the neuron. Yep. So you may feel it for a long time, right?
It's really funny though when it happens.
No, it is not funny. Even doing that kind of makes you feel like, ugh, that uncomfortable feeling. Okay. So middle of your page, you've got a couple of terms there. Let me draw your attention to number 4 and then A. And B. Okay, this is page 96, number 4, letters A and B. You ever sit at a stoplight, somebody revs their engine next to you, light turns green, their car sputters and sits. And there you go, you drive off past them and you leave them sitting at the stoplight. What do they not reach?
Threshold.
They were doing what's called a graded potential. That means there's a little bit of excitement at a particular part of your cell, but it went nowhere. And so they just sat there and their car turned off and that's it. End of story. They went back to resting state. So sometimes you have a little bit of excitement at a localized part of a neuron. That's called a graded potential. But the catch is you may not have reached threshold. Now, if you want to turn a graded potential into an action potential, what do you have to hit?
Threshold.
Yeah, got to get it to negative 55. And what does that mean as coming into your nerve cell?
Sodium.
You've got enough coming in to hit that negative 55 value. So think of the graded potential as the guy sitting at the stoplight, revving his engine, car cuts off. There it goes. That's a graded potential. Okay. The next term there we need to talk about is called hyperpolarization. And I think what I'll do is I'll introduce hyperpolarization. Let's flip the page and talk about resting state, restoring that resting state, and we'll talk about hyperpolarization there. Mind the big picture here. We're watching an action potential travel from, say, the cell body down an axon, down toward that axon terminals, and then it's going to jump over to a neighboring cell. What's going to happen, though, is we have to come right along behind with a cleanup crew to restore the resting state of this cell. We call that repolarization. Repolarization means we're restoring the resting state. So right now, we've got kind of a mess. If you look at the action potential page, we've got a bunch of, you know, sodiums inside. We've got a positive charge in there. Let's add that positive charge inside. Got a negative charge outside. Okay, and so we've got to clean all of that back to our resting state in order to conduct another action potential. Until you clean up this mess, you cannot send another action potential down this axon. It will not conduct another nerve impulse. So that's what repolarization is. We've got to clean everything up to our resting state, and then we've got to get it ready for another nerve impulse to come. Okay, so a couple things we've got to do here. We've got to make sure the charge on the inside returns to a negative 70 millivolts. The way that we do that is by letting the majority of our ions leak back outside. Instead of letting the sodiums out, those potassiums are the ones that actually leak outside first. Okay, so I'll just put a potassium channel here. Okay, so the first thing that happens is those potassiums begin to leak outside, and they do so in droves. And when they leak to the outside of our nerve cell, they restore the negative 70 millivolt charge to the inside of our cell. That may look like everything's good, right? Because our goal is to get back to a resting state of negative 70. Bingo, you got sodium inside, and of course that's a problem because we need to get that back outside. Now, if enough of those potassiums leak out, actually the charge will become even more negative. So if you've got tons of potassiums leaking out, instead of just getting to negative 70, you may go to negative 90, you may go to negative 110. That is called hyperpolarization. So if too many exit, you may actually make your cell even more negative. So one last thing here, in order to get those sodiums from the inside back out and the potassiums from the outside back in, you have to use what? That pump, right? And how many sodiums will it move back outside?
Three.
Three back out, and how many potassiums back in?
Two.
Two. You're going to be in a refractory period. You cannot fire another nerve impulse until you finish that pumping process. So that pump is going to be the critical component here for three sodiums out and two potassiums back in. Okay, so there's two things that happen here. Potassiums leak, and then the sodium-potassium pump comes up and restores those ions back to their original location. And until you finish that job, this nerve cell cannot conduct another impulse. So I'd like to hit this entire process again with you. We'll do page 98 as well. But if you want to practice at home, pages 99, 100, and 101 should probably do you pretty good. We'll go over those as well on Monday. All right, y'all have a good weekend.